Thank you. Good afternoon. Thanks for taking a little time out of what I know is just a blizzard of things to do here at the annual meeting to come visit with us here. And I hope we will hear your ideas and thoughts. I'm going to talk about health reform and in particular why I'm involved in a campaign to mobilize women around health reform and some of the strategies we've been using. There are some materials in the back from our campaign, which you can take on the way out. So first of all, why focus on women? I get this question all the time, particularly from men. And there's some good reasons. First of all, women have some health status issues that are particular to women. For example, we have a higher percentage of women in who say they're in fair health or poor health than men. A higher percentage of women with a chronic condition requiring ongoing care, and a higher use of prescription drugs, according to this Kaiser Family Foundation survey. But there are other reasons to focus on women as an organizing, mobilizing group for health reform. First of all, we're a key healthcare voter bloc. I've been doing a lot of work with Celinda Lake, the national pollster, around health reform, and she's been very clear that women, especially Democratic women and women of color, are the key folks behind health reform in the United States. Also, women, or as any of the women in this room can tell you, are often the healthcare decision makers for our entire families, making the doctors and dentist appointments for our kids and our husbands and our partners, and also taking care of all the ailing elderly relatives that need our help. Women have particular health needs that often may not be well served. For example, reproductive health, which is my own background and specialty, is an area that's not particularly well served by the health system. We have special issues with health insurance, which I'll get into a little more in a minute. And we also see health reform as a broader public health issue, seeing how it's connected to the lack of, say, recreation activities in our neighborhood, the lack of healthy food choices in many parts of, say, New York City where I live. We see those as part of health reform and public health. So our goals in this project, Raising Women's Voices for the Healthcare We Need, have been to ensure that women's perspectives about our healthcare needs and those of our families can be powerfully articulated in healthcare reform dialogues, both on national and state level, and to try to influence the development of state and national health reform policies. So here are some of the steps that we've taken, and I'm going to offer these specific steps, but I want you to think about them as the kinds of steps you could use for any public health mobilization campaign. First of all, we needed to identify and articulate the key healthcare issues that are of concern to women. Then we wanted to educate women's health advocates about health reform. What is it? How does it work? What do people mean when they talk about single payer? What are some of these terms? We needed to design a campaign that gives women concrete steps to take in our own home communities. And we wanted to build and empower a network of advocates to carry out the campaign. So first, we wanted to identify key issues for women in health reform. And of course, we did things like consult the literature and study polling research, but we did something else different that I highly recommend as both a way to gather information and also to engage and empower the grassroots. We started our campaign by conducting approximately 20 small group discussions with targeted women's constituencies. And we did these both in New York City and in Boston, where my partner in this, Billy Avery, the founder of the Black Women's Health Imperative, was working. We did groups with young women who talked about things like how they had trouble getting birth control and affording birth control. We talked with new mothers, many of them very angry about being unable to use midwives because their health insurance wouldn't cover it, or talking about the lousy experiences they had in some of the public hospitals with childbearing, you know, just feeling like they were cogs in a big machine and nobody cared about them. Immigrant women had a lot of stories to tell. We did one that I just will never forget with Southeast Asian women in Queens who were victims of domestic violence. And it turned out that their top priority for health care was dental care because they had been suffering battering so much from their husbands that they were ashamed and embarrassed to go out into the street, and yet they had no dental care. So we learned a tremendous amount from those groups, and actually we're continuing to do them now. We use the information from those sessions to build a set of principles, which we call a woman's vision for quality, affordable health care for all. And it is that that has been the basis of our work. We have gotten back to those women over and over and told them what we're doing and rewarded them, thanked them for the perspectives that they gave us. And they have, in turn, talked to their neighbors and friends and communities, and it started like little ripples of action and interest out in the community. In terms of women and health insurance, there are a lot of things I could point out, but the most important one I want to point out is right here. 24% of women have health insurance through their spouses or partners. This is a higher percentage than men. And that's a very significant factor when you look about women and health insurance, because through divorce or death of a spouse, you could suddenly have no health insurance. And it's an issue that's of particular concern to women that we've tried to address. We also looked at which women are at greater risk of being uninsured. And I'm sure it's no surprise to many of you in the room that it's foreign-born women, Native Americans, Latinas, young women, women with less than a high school education, single parents, near poor and poor. And so we've designed a lot of our work around these groups because they are the groups who are most at risk and most at need of health reform. So we identified a number of issues that are particular to women and health insurance. For example, many women are in part-time or low-paying jobs that do not offer health insurance coverage. And one of the most egregious examples of this is the women who are home health care workers. Here they are providing health care to other people, and most of them don't have health care. We've been working with a group called Healthcare for Healthcare Workers nationally, which is trying to advocate for those women. It's a tremendous need among this population. As I mentioned, one quarter of women have dependent coverage, and so we've been working on policies like there's one in, I think it's the state of Vermont, that says you can keep your health insurance coverage for 2 years after a divorce so that you have time to get another source of health insurance coverage. High copays and deductibles are really a problem for women. We might have health insurance, but we don't make as much as men, and these copays and deductibles can be really, really an obstacle, particularly if we have kids that like have to go to the dentist a lot of times. It can be one copay after another, and then, you know, we're in trouble in terms of the family budget. Also, increasingly, insurers are denying coverage to people with pre-existing conditions. And for women, that can include breast cancer, it can include pregnancy. And recently, there have been some articles out about how women who've had C-section deliveries in the past are being denied health insurance coverage now because the insurers don't want to pay for another C-section. And if you've already had a C-section, you're more likely to have one the next time around. Health insurers can use gender rating to charge women more in many states. California is one of them. And coverage may not include the services that women want, birth control, midwives, and so on. So our first strategy in this campaign was to figure out whether the women we were targeting were able to participate in the healthcare reform debate. And we decided, no, they weren't. That most of the women that we were working with had no idea about the concepts and terms of health reform. They really didn't understand what these different ideas were about getting us to universal health care. So our first strategy then was to educate women about health reform. We sponsored 3 national webinars on women in health reform, in which we had people translating the terminology into like plain English for folks who could really understand it, and also into plain Spanish. We established a website and a blog that has a lot of this material on it, including the webinars are archived on there, so you can listen to them anytime you want. We held a national conference in Boston last April, training 260 women from 28 states. These were key women's health advocates who we knew could carry the message back. And we've been giving a lot of conference presentations to women's health advocates. So how do we design a campaign that will motivate women to get working on this issue? We, from our work with the small groups and from the polling research we got from Celinda Lake, we selected 3 issues to focus on: affordability of health coverage, health disparities, and pre-existing conditions, denials of coverage for pre-existing conditions. We developed fact sheets and talking points. We targeted the election season with candidate forums and town hall meetings, and we also asked women to become involved in campaigns that were going on from other groups. So some of the things that we came up with were like little giveaways like this. It's a fan that has the campaign, promoted on the front of it. It has our principles on the back. And it was great over the summer at all the fairs and outdoor events. And we were thinking, oh, nobody would want them now that it's the fall. But it turns out that women who have hot flashes have been asking for these because they're very, very handy. So I have more of them if anyone wants one. No hot flashes back here, but you can have one. How we go about building and empowering an advocacy network? Well, we decided that we needed to have an advisory board that would represent some of the women, targeted women's groups. So we have this advisory board, and it has on it representatives from groups like African American Women Evolving. It's a Chicago-based group. Physicians for a National Health Program, Our Bodies Ourselves, the Women's Health Book Collective, the Colorado Organization for Latina Opportunity and Reproductive Rights, the American Medical Women's Association, Breast Cancer Action, the Black Women's Health Imperative, Childbirth Connection. So you get the idea that we try to get someone from each of these constituencies, and we've been having quarterly conference calls with them to test out all our ideas. Like, is this going to work with your constituency, the one that you represent? If not, tell us what else we should do. Then we hired regional coordinators around the country to mobilize women in their own regions because we figured the regional coordinators were no better than we. Who are the key local people to target and what kind of events are coming up. We trained a key group of women's health advocates on a national conference call about this campaign, talked about the issues. We came up with a bi-weekly e-newsletter that we've been sending out to this huge list of emails that we have accumulated over the last year. And in that newsletter, we offer examples of what women have been doing around the country. So when a woman in Woodstock, New York, went and talked to her local congressman, we got her to write up what she did, and we got a picture of her, and we put it in the e-newsletter so that other people could see how it's done. When a group from Texas, a single-payer health advocacy group, went to a rally and took a lot of our flyers and talked about women's health, we featured it. And we have also, in the newsletter, been publishing notices about upcoming events that women's health advocates have been holding and health reform advocates so that women all around the country can find out about these things and participate. And we produced and distributed the kind of giveaways that I just showed you. I wanted to mention that this project is a collaboration of my MergerWatch project with the Avery Institute for Social Change and the National Women's Health Network based in Washington. We've had some initial funding support from the Ford Foundation and the Ms. Foundation for Women in their coalition building initiative. And we invite you to visit our website and get involved. And during the question and answer period, I'd be happy to talk more about how we came up with these ideas and how it's working. So thanks so much.
Thank you, Lois. Our next speaker is Gerard Ratavosian.
Hi, everyone. It's nice to be in the company of troublemakers like myself. So thank you all very much for coming. Jose said, I'm the U.S. field coordinator for PHR's Health Action AIDS campaign, which happens to be the largest campaign at PHR. I'm going to take a step back. Some of the things that I'm going to be talking about. Can you hear me okay? Some of the things that I'll be talking about, Lewis already mentioned, but I'm going to actually take a step back and go through some of the thought processes that we go through in our own campaign before going into more details about how we were able to mobilize health professionals to influence global AIDS legislation, which PEPFAR passed, as you all know, in July 2008. So with that introduction. So first of all, what is advocacy? I think it's important for all of us to be on the same page and to define a terminology that we all sort of just throw out there sometimes. Advocacy is identifying a problem, identifying solutions to a problem, and then figuring out a way to build the support you need to see the solutions come through. And our campaign goes through these sort of eight steps in putting together a strategy for mobilizing health professionals. And we'll go through each one of these steps, but I just want to point out that there are some terminologies like tactics, for example. Tactics are the building blocks of advocacy, and I'll show you how we choose how to pick tactics and when determining strategy. And strategy, speaking of strategy, I think that's, if there's one thing you're going to remember from what I say today, it's that being strategic is very important. So when you're formulating your own campaign, when you go back home and put together your own campaign, it's important to be strategic. It's important to be thoughtful in the process. Strategy, as you know, is the overall map that guides the use of the tactics to get the goals that you want. So think about strategy as we're going through this. So number one, define the problem. It's important to bring people together. As Lewis said, they had focus group discussions. They talked to women because people with common concerns people with common concerns working together are the most effective. And I would argue that it's good to reach out to diverse groups, both men and women, both rural and urban, rich and poor. And it's also important to get to reach out to relevant groups, so doctors and nurses. Sometimes you just want nurses. Sometimes you only want public health specialists, for example, or community members. So it's important to make sure that you bring the right the first step is to bring the right people into the room to figure out what the problem is, who needs, and to get the community's input and figure out where to go from there. So for example, if you're designing a campaign about an environmental issue, you want to make sure you have the environmental specialist in the room, for example, or public health specialists that specialize in environmental health issues. So once you figure out what the problem is and you figure out who's in the room and I'd identify how you want to move forward, one of the most important but difficult aspects of developing a campaign is setting clear goals and objectives. So, and it's difficult because it's time-consuming. And the more people you have in the room, coming to consensus on the goals and objectives can take a long time. And it's important, though. It's important because the success of your advocacy campaign will be measured by the extent to which the objectives are achieved. And it's also important because as you develop tactics and targets later on, you'll notice that targets will be chosen based on what your objectives are. So it's important to take the time to put together clear and clear goals and objectives of your advocacy campaign. And we have a little acronym. It's not anything special. I'm sure you've all heard of it, SMART. When you're developing objectives, it's important that they're specific so that they're addressing a real need. They're measurable. Oh, my God. Can you guys hear me now? They're measurable. They're appropriate, so they're related to the needs. They're realistic, so they can be achieved within your means. So as part of your strategy development, you have to figure out how much human and financial resources you have, and also that they're time-bound, so that they're clearly within appropriate objectives will be met. So once you have your campaign goals and objectives, it's important to know the facts. Effective advocacy depends on strong analysis of the situation you are addressing. Facts must be directly related to your identified goals and objectives. Facts are powerful. I think it was the past president said yesterday that when you meet with a legislator, you don't want to give them pie charts or p-values. You want to make sure that policymakers have very important facts, that they're organized, that they're clearly labeled. And as we're going through how our campaign mobilized around PEPFAR, I'll show you some of the fact sheets that we use and how we put information together Yeah. So once you have your facts in order, it's important to choose your targets. So once you know what you want, it's time to figure out who can give you what you want. And the shortest distance between two points is a straight line. What you need to figure out is who is a target and what is the shortest distance between you and the target that can get you what you want. So who has the power to make the change you want and is the most vulnerable to the kinds of pressure you can mount? This is really important because if you're depending on what kind of campaign you are or how big your campaign is, you can't. The targets that you will choose are going to be very appropriate to your own specific campaign. So you have to, in analyzing this, and we'll do an exercise quickly together, you have to figure out which are the kinds of targets that you can pressure with your given resources. So then there's primary targets and secondary targets. Primary targets are the person or institution with the ultimate power. It's always good to have a specific person as a target rather than an institution. If the institution is a target, you've got to figure out who the leader is. So if you're targeting APHA, you need to know the name of the person that you're targeting. If it's George Benjamin, then he's your target. You know, and sometimes for example, if Dr. Benjamin is not your target, if you're too far away from the main target, you create a secondary target. A secondary target is usually the person able to influence the primary target. So keep this in mind, and when we go through an exercise, you'll see what I'm talking about. And remember when we said, when we're talking about objectives, it's important that you choose your targets based on your objectives. So power mapping. Who's heard of power mapping in the room? Just curious. So a couple of folks. So power mapping is it's an exercise you do to map out the power dynamics across your campaign so that you focus on the main target, the person who can give you the change you want. And then doing that, you also figure out the opposition that's against your campaign and as well and how to minimize the opposition that's against your campaign. So when we talk about power mapping, there's a primary target checklist. So you have a target. You need to know how knowledgeable is the target to your issues. How much time do you have to spend to educate them? Do they support your goals? Do they support your objectives? Are they on your side? Where are they in the middle? Are they on the left? Are they on the right? How accessible are they? Are they vulnerable? Could they switch sides? Are they dead set in their position? If they are, maybe it's not a good use of your time. Could you neutralize their opposition? What issues do they care about? Do they care about your issue? If they don't care about your issue, how can you get them to care about your issue? These are all questions you need to think about when you're identifying a target. What information or arguments have moved them and they're most likely to be moved by? That's an awkward sentence, but anyway. Power mapping continues. How can you influence them? Do they know your organization? Do they respond to your constituency? Every time we meet with a member of Congress, the first thing that we say is, we're a human rights organization that's 22 years old, and in 1997, we were the co-recipients of the Nobel Peace Prize. First sentence, first thing we say. That's how you demonstrate power over your target. Do they respond to your constituency? If a member of Congress is your target, you need to show the member of Congress how many constituents you have in their district. That's how you exert the pressure. So when we meet with members of Congress, we say, we've got 600 members in your district, or X number of student chapters in your district. That's very important. And then influencing their district and region. So do they belong to a party in power, or do they hold any other high ranks? What are some of their personal affiliations, religious, social, university, within APHA, for example, since we're mobilizing around a public health issue, city and state public health departments? Do you have connections you can use? These are all questions you need to think about when you're choosing a primary target. And sometimes who influences the primary target? And this is how you get to the secondary targets. And what power do you have over the secondary targets? So now you have a primary target, assuming at this point. It's important, it's very useful to be clear about the political environment in which you're working in. So you have to understand the policy-making structures, the policy-making processes. If what you want, you need to figure out how you get what you want. Is it a bill? Is it a public commenting process? Is it a letter that the target needs to produce? It's important to understand the framework and the relevant legal and policy frameworks in which you're operating in. What are the opportunities and timing for input into policymaking? So the last point here is creating a campaign calendar. So at some point, what we do is we do what's called an energy cycle map, where we map out members of Congress's, for example, energy cycle, and then the energy cycle of our constituents and see where there is overlap. So if you're mobilizing students are not going to be that high in the energy cycle during the summer times when they're on vacation. Members of Congress are out for the summer. We know that. They're out now because they're campaigning for the election. So it's important to have a campaign calendar so that you know how your constituency energy cycle overlaps with the ones of your target's energy cycle. So where are we? Step six. So building alliances and coalitions. Different groups have diverse perspectives and different connections and areas of influence that they can bring to push the agenda forward. So it's important to reach out, and Lewis, you talked about some of this as well, and to get to know and consult other stakeholders in the community. Establish a presence in existing networks. Build partnerships and coalitions with like-minded stakeholders. Obviously, working together is likely to achieve the best result, but there are some drawbacks that you need to be careful of. If you reach out to a large coalition, for example, you have to make sure that everyone agrees and everyone's on the same page about your goals and objectives. And it may be difficult and it might be time consuming to make sure that everyone's on the same page, but it's important for that to happen. So now, choosing your tactics. So tactics are the steps in carrying out the overall plan or strategy of your advocacy campaign, sometimes called actions. And usually a good action is one that's focused on the primary target or the secondary target. It puts power behind a specific demand. So as you're doing the tactic, you're showing your power over the target. It meets your organization's goals as well as your issue goals. This is very important. And it's within the experience of your members and their comfort zone. So not all tactics are going to be appropriate for all campaigns and for all organizations. Even though you're working on the same issue, different tactics are, you choose tactics based on your constituency and in your campaign and your organizations. And this is why building coalitions is important. I'll show you in just a second. For example, if you've got a campaign and you're working on issues that affect senior citizens, for example, and they're your constituency, you're not going to, well, maybe you will, but you're not going to send them to a rally, for example. So the rally is not a tactic you may want to choose, for example. So in our campaign, we had, I'll show you some pictures of how we partner with other coalitions members within the Global AIDS Roundtable and how their tactics were different than ours, but they're all very important and complementary. And then the last step, Jose, you're going to kill me. This is the last step, I promise, is to renew, review, and re-energize. This is important because with every long journey, you need to re-strategize, you need to think of, you need to see how far, whether your objectives have been met, you need to learn from your gains and losses in your campaign. There's a monitoring and evaluation is very important. You can do a result evaluation, which focuses on whether you're getting where you want to go. A process evaluation focuses on how efficiently you're getting there. And then you want to involve your coalition members, of course. Along the way, it's best to be meeting with your groups and so that the groups stay together and then they address the new strategies and new tactics together as the campaign grows and changes. It's okay to change strategy halfway through. It happens all the time. And it's important to recognize that and learn from the changes. And it's also important to monitor and evaluate because it demonstrates your campaign's impact to funders and grant makers as well. So now let's talk about PHR's Health Action AIDS campaign and how we mobilize health professionals to pass the largest global AIDS legislation ever, the largest public health legislation ever, PEPFAR, in July 2008. So PHR, remember we said we put together a strategy about a couple of years ago. We came together with some of our colleagues, and I recognize them here in the room right now. We picked some target states, so we can't be everywhere. We're a national organization. We can't organize in all states. So based on our resources, based on what we have on the ground, based on where we want to build our constituency, we put together some key states, California, Florida, Maine, New Hampshire, Minnesota, Kansas, New York. They have nothing in common. Don't try to figure it out. It was very specific to our campaign, very specific to our organization's needs. So here's just going through the pictures. Up top, there's a picture of a house party that we organized in New York with Representative Nita Lowey. Those were health professionals in the room next to Nita Lowey sitting on a living room couch. When she walked in, she knew that the people in the room were health professionals. She even recognized that health professionals were smarter than she was in these issues, and she recognized we were able to demonstrate power that we had over Nita Lowey. In the bottom picture, it's a summit that we organized earlier this year where we brought health professionals from all across the country to Washington, D.C., where we do trainings. Lewis, you guys do trainings as well. And the first day we do trainings, and the second day we send them to the Hill to meet with our members of Congress. So helping your members, your constituents, in training them in advocacy is a big part of your strategy. 2 minutes left. Oh, my gosh. All right. So health professionals, We were talking about fact sheets. We were talking about knowing your facts. Here are some of the fact sheets that we designed. Healthy rights equals healthy woman, which was our commitment to halt the feminization of the epidemic. You see, it's nice. It looks beautiful. The facts are clearly laid out. When you go to a member of Congress, you show that to a member of Congress, it's very impactful. Here's some of the reports that we produced and the letter that we were circulating. And it's not surprising that some of the language that were in our fact sheets and reports ended up being in the legislation, most notably boosting efforts to address African health workforce shortage, maintaining harm reduction for injecting drug users, and lifting the HIV travel ban. Almost done. So another way of exerting pressure and expertise is we mobilize health professionals in Uganda and in Kenya as well. So we coordinate our advocacy efforts to the extent possible with the networks that exist in Kenya and in Uganda. So you see from the pictures that our partners in Kenya organized an AIDS Week of Action at the same time that we did in the U.S. And here's a very active medical student who's chasing a bus full of students collecting petition signatures. And then periodically we bring over leading AIDS experts to the U.S. From Uganda and Kenya. We have one traveling with us right now as we speak, Dr. Eliota Temuseji. That's him right there with Congressman Howard Berman of Los Angeles. The picture is just a few days old. And then in the critical final weeks of the reauthorization process, thousands of health professionals repeatedly called and wrote with members and targeted legislators to provide them with essential facts about PEPFAR. And that's just a picture of a town meeting that we recently organized again with Howard Berman. Everything in that picture is strategic. The fact that Mr. Berman is in the center is strategic. The fact that Eliota is sitting next to Mr. Berman is strategic. The fact that the room is filled with key stakeholders and health professionals that are wearing their white coats is strategic. And you better bet that Mr. Berman will notice that. And the picture on the bottom is a congressional briefing that we organized earlier this year where we were talking about the feminization of the epidemic to staff members in Congress. Almost done. This is why it's important to have coalition, to be parts of coalitions and working with partners. Some of these tactics are not tactics that PHR necessarily takes part in. For example, the fire rallies, it's great. It's very impactful. It's very important. Makes the news. It carries the agenda forward. But what we did is we took medical students on the Hill with their white coat and they delivered postcards, for example. It's not to say that one tactic is better than the other. They're all very important as long as they're coordinated and they're strategic, but you have to choose the tactics that are most appropriate for your campaign and your organization. Last slide, I think. So this is just to show that you always have to be on top of new technology and try things that are different outside of your comfort zone. We organized our members to create video postcard messages. Amy Hagopian, who was in the room, Amy, wave your hand. She was in the video all the way on the bottom. So what we did is we created DVDs with these videos and we sent them to members of Congress and we sent them links to them and they all carry a very specific message. We haven't talked about this, but media is very important. It's important. Media is a tactic, and during the reauthorization process, we helped our members write letters to the editor and opinion editorial pieces. And this particular piece, which we helped, which we influenced the writer Michael Gerson to produce, literally reinstated the reauthorization process. During the PEPFAR, you may remember that the bill was stalled. When this came out, got it going again. Almost done, Jose. So you have all this information. How do you take it back to your own campaign? It's important to know what resources you have, careful stock of your advocacy resources, what past advocacy work your organization has done, what alliances already exist, and then you can figure out what are the gaps that still need to happen, what advocacy resources you need that aren't there, and then first efforts is how do you begin? Do you want to start with a small win? If a small win rallies your base, that's the way to go. And then evaluation, we talked about that. It's very important. I'm going to skip over this last slide, but it's usually the first slide we show. You all know that as public health professionals, our voices are uniquely positioned to influence policy and that we have a very powerful role to play in the struggle for human rights. Sorry, we don't have enough time. And then I'll end with this poem. I don't know if it's a poem or what it is, but it's something that Emma Goldman said, a revolution without dancing is not a revolution worth having. Advocacy campaigns take a long time, so you have to make sure you're having fun, people in your campaign are healthy, and you're staying healthy, and you're enjoying the ride. That's it. Sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gerard. And our last speaker today is going to be Howard Pollack.
Well, I think the first two speakers have said it all, so I could sit down. But it's remarkable how we've used a similar layout for our presentations here. Microsoft does a wonderful job on PowerPoint. So I'm going to be talking about a statewide campaign in California over the last decade or more, since I've been involved in it since the early 90s. Sometimes public health takes a long time, but it's been a terrific ride. We've been very successful. And I was pleased to hear the welcome addressed by the supervisor from the San Diego Board of Supervisors yesterday at the opening session. And the first programmatic program that came out of his mouth was water fluoridation, the pride that he had with that. And so that shows, to me, that's a success. When a politician espouses the program that you want to have happen. So being here in San Diego at this particular time is very fortuitous, because San Diego has been the largest city in the United States that has been unfluoridated, and we're coming to a point now where that's changing. I don't have any personal financial relationships with any commercial interests, blah, blah, blah. So as you've heard, I tend to think of these things as a pie. That is, the A is assessment, P is planning or public policy development, I is implementation, and the E for the pie, P-I-E, pie, would be evaluation. But in public health, we call it assurance, and that's the essential methodology of public health. And if the quality isn't working, we go back to the beginning. We're back in assessment again, and we try to continue to improve. We were lucky enough to find ourselves in a situation in the early 90s where there was omnibus legislation out of Congress that seemed to require state health departments through MCH to have an oral health plan, an oral health assessment of the people of that state. And so we were able to get some funding from MCH in the state to do a needs assessment of children in California. We found that it wasn't sufficient money, so we went to get some more money, and we got some from the Wellness Foundation at that time in California. And we collected data in 92, 93 throughout the state, and I was the PI on that project, and we came up with these reports, one called the Neglected Epidemic, that the title was stolen from Myron Aloukian, a past president of the American Public Health Association from Boston. The full report came out a couple of years later. And what this showed was that we in California, it's a beautiful place. It's a nice hotel. We've got a lovely swimming pool. But it's a very poor state. And two out of every five children come from a family that's designated as poor in California. The problem that we have with our population is a fairly high level of tooth decay, and that was born out of the assessment. Whether it's in children or adults, tooth decay often involves a lot of pain and suffering, going to the dentist for treatment, crown buildups, root canals, bridges, extractions, terms that nobody likes to think about too much, but everybody at some point in time has experienced. How many of you have experienced some of these problems? And it's probably universal, isn't it? It's not like a disease that only a few people get. So it is a problem, and we need to address it. It is such a significant problem that in the Surgeon General's report in 2000, tooth decay was identified as the most common chronic childhood disease, 5 times more common than asthma. Yet we don't think of tooth decay as a disease. But if you've ever had a toothache or a swollen face or an abscess, or if your gums bleed when you brush, you've got some sort of dental disease. It's not affecting just children, but adults, and we're keeping our teeth flossing to the grave, as it were, and so the roots of our teeth get exposed and we get cavities on the root surfaces. I showed this particular slide for two reasons. One is that catchy little thing that where things move across the screen. And I first saw a PowerPoint presentation with that kind of presentation from the anti-fluoridationists. They are the opposition to moving ahead with water fluoridation. And they spend an awful lot of time trying to put forward their point of view. So while we're trying to campaign for fluoridation, they're trying to campaign against us. And they're reasonably well organized, sometimes more organized than we are. And so when you've got a campaign that you've got a very well-identified opposition group, your tactics have to be, you have to take them into consideration. This statement by Surgeon General Koop, that fluoridation is the single most important commitment a community can make to the oral health of its children and to future generations, became a very important statement. And I always repeat that to my dental students at UCSF, and I say, it's the single most important, blah, blah, blah. And if it is the single most important, then we ought to be doing something about it, rather than leaving it up to somebody else. When we look at the distribution of communities that are served by public water supplies that are fluoridated, it's like a patchwork, and there's no consistent pattern across states. So it's all politics is local. In California, currently we have just over 25, maybe 27% of our population designated as fluoridated, living in a fluoridated area. It's actually slightly higher than that because of recent events that I'll talk about in a minute. So we were a little bit behind the curve in terms of population served in California. At that particular time, it was about 2/3 of the nation had fluoridated water. California, only about 1/4. If you ask people, are you opposed to fluoridation or you're in favor of fluoridation, 3/4 of the people, 3 out of every 4, say that they are in favor of water fluoridation. However, some of the people don't know what fluoridation is for, but they're in favor of it. And so you have to sort of think about the socially acceptable response factor that, oh, yes, I agree with you, kind of response. But certainly the majority of people think that the water should be fluoridated. In 1994, the Dental Health Foundation, a small nonprofit organization based in California, sent out letters, and this is a copy of the letter to me on the left, saying that I'm invited to become a member of the California Fluoridation Task Force. So this was born out of several years of effort and some funding to bring together interested parties to form this task force and to see what could be done. In 94, I already said that in 92, 93, we'd collected data on the needs of California children. So we were in the process of disseminating that information. And the group was put together by 6 organizations. Represented the Dental Health Foundation, the California Department of Health Services, California Dental Association, the 2 local affiliates of the American Public Health Association, and the California Dental Hygienists Association. And that was important, although it was really the individuals that were identified as key players, and we knew that they were associated with these organizations, so that we could carry on this effort through those organizations. Even if one member dropped out, we could go back to that organization and have somebody else there. You need a champion. And Jackie Speier was the most effective consumer legislator in California. At the time, in 1995, when she introduced the California Fluoridation Bill, she was the state assembly woman from an area just south of San Francisco. And the reason that she got interested in this particular topic was that she had some children who, when they lived in her home in San Mateo County, was served by fluoridated water. And when she lived in Sacramento, where she served in the state legislature and had a home there, her children also lived there. And her pediatrician suggested that they be taking fluoride supplements because the water is not fluoridated. And she said, what a crazy kind of a policy that if you live in this area, you're supposed to take the pills, and if you live in that area, you're not supposed to take the pills. And taking the daily fluoride supplement is not easy to implement over a long period of time, from, you know, the age of 6 months to 16 years every day, to get somebody to comply with that. So she was willing to introduce this bill, and it was actually passed in the same year. Not without opposition from the anti-fluoridationists, so-called. But we were successful, and she then later became a state senator, and most recently has been elected with an overwhelming majority from her area to the Congress in the House of Representatives to take Tom Lantos' seat. And I think she's going to be very effective in Congress. The projections are that we are going to almost meet the Healthy People 2010 goals of 75% of the population served by water fluoridation. We've grown since the early 90s, and we project quite soon that it'll be in the 70% range. We can map out where, by zip code, which areas are fluoridated, which are not. This map is slightly out of date. It's not complete. It needs to be updated, that's an ongoing process. You can see in this table here that, let me just step to the side, because I know that the people who are right there can't see anything behind me, and I apologize for that. But just the difference between 2006 and 2007, you can see that the numbers of people served by fluoridated water has doubled from 11 million to 22 million. And this is because of the Metropolitan Water District that has been fluoridated since the end of 2007. In 2003, they voted, and what we did with money that we got from the California Endowment — the California Endowment seems to give money to everybody. You just have to ask, and they give it. It's great. Not anymore. Okay. They were willing to give $15 million to the effort to fluoridate communities in California, targeting communities that they thought would benefit the most. And along the way, we thought that if we could get further upstream — how am I doing on time? If we get further upstream, fluoridate the wholesaler, then the communities below that take the water from that wholesaler, that we would have a bigger bang for the buck. So rather than target cities like Los Angeles that we got fluoridated in 1999, that in Sacramento that we got fluoridated in around the same time, we also decided to target the Metropolitan Water District as a community, which is really a board of representatives of 26 member agencies in Southern California. We had a champion, Glenn Peterson. You need a champion. You need somebody who can affect change. And he was honored by the California Department of Health Services for his role in advocating for fluoridation, and the vote was two-thirds in favor of fluoridation. talk a little bit about opposition. It's in every community. There are anti-fluoridationists in this room. Maybe they don't identify themselves as anti-fluoridationists, but they've got questions, they have doubts, they've read something, they've seen something on the internet, and they're not sure. We're currently going through a process of getting a policy, updated policy on community water fluoridation. The American Public Health Association's had a policy on its books since the early 50s, supporting water fluoridation. And they always ask for equal time, which is annoying. Because really, the vast, vast majority of healthcare professionals favor fluoridation. However, the Fluoride Action Network is one of the websites that you can go to, and you can see terrible things written about me, okay? There are some good websites. The American Dental Association. Jane McGinley's here from the American Dental Association and is an expert on water fluoridation. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the NIDCR, one of the institutes of the NIH, and then looking at other countries that are promoting fluoridation as well. This is the ADA website and some, you know, just one of the pages, and there's a lot of information that's good information there. It's evidence-based. It's good stuff. CDC also has good stuff on fluoridation. So when you see the other stuff coming on the web, take a look at these sites as well. As you know, community water fluoridation has been labeled as one of the top 10 or the 10 great public health achievements of the 20th century. That is a very important statement that we can use when we're going out into communities. It's a very, very powerful statement. The American Dental Association every 5 years or so reviews the latest literature and puts out fluoridation facts. And this is available online now. And it's an excellent resource, well over 300 references in it, a Q&A format, and it's just a very well put thing put together. So if there are questions or comments, I'll take them after this these presentations. I just want to leave you with this final slide, because tomorrow at 12:30 in the Santa Rosa Room downstairs, we're going to have another session devoted entirely to fluoridation in California and San Diego. And we'll have Ron Roberts, who's supervisor of the San Diego County, and Scott Peters, who's the president of the City Council for San Diego there. I look forward very much to seeing some of you there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to the presenters. This is one of the first times in the 20 years I've been coming to APHA where we're actually going to have time for question and answer, so thank you. I don't think I introduced myself. I'm Jose Ramon Fernandez Peña from San Francisco State University, and as I mentioned in the beginning, I'm with the Action Board at APHA. I've been trying to take notes throughout the presentations, and you've just heard three very different issues dealt with similar steps. So slightly different strategies, slightly different number of steps mentioned by everybody, but I think that in common we heard a little bit about the need to clearly define and understand the issue we're talking about, collecting data to support the idea, speaking with key informants, ensuring that the community is involved as key partners in the process, finding partners, champions, and enemies, conducting a power analysis. That was a really very beautiful presentation, Girard, about that piece. Hey, funders as well, another very important piece of the puzzle, defining the steps, the actions, the tactics, evaluating, reporting, and disseminating the findings. So I would like to open it now for any questions from the audience. Please.
I want to know if Girard,
yeah.
Do you have a website that your presentation is available on, so we can get copies of it?
I can email it to you.
Okay.
Yeah, the specific presentation, I can email it to you afterwards.
Right.
But PHR's website is physiciansforhumanrights.org.
PHR.org?
PHRUSA.org.
Would they find the presentation in that website?
No.
No.
But I can give it the presentation.
Okay. Yes.
Girard, those were, by the way, three very good presentations. Thank you to each of you. And interesting to see such different content areas, but using very similar strategies. You talked about assembling facts, but one of the things I know about PHR is that you also assemble stories. And I think those can be as powerful. especially in an area like health, where it's such a human intervention and human involvement, and the stories, I think, can be as powerful as the fact.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree.
You wanna?
I don't have much to add, but I think, as Howard pointed out, the reason why Jackie Spears was influenced is because there was a story behind why she cared about the issue. And I absolutely agree.
In fact, let me see if I can just close this out. So yeah, that's better. with the Women in Health Reform Project, stories have been a major element of what we've been doing. As I told you, we started out with those small group discussions, and we recorded them, and we gathered the stories from all the women who were at those forums. And we've been using those stories when we talk with legislators, when we talk with various policymakers, to illustrate the issue. Because, you know, facts are important, statistics are important, but stories really are a better way of communicating. And so actually, along that lines, I neglected to announce before that tomorrow at 12:30, we're having a women's speak out for healthcare for all here at the APHA conference. And we'll be gathering some of those stories. And as well, if you want to mark your calendars for next year, April 1st in New York City at NYU Law School, we're going to have a national women's speak out for health reform, moderated by Dr. Nancy Snyderman, who's the NBC medical correspondent. And we hope to have it publicized perhaps on C-SPAN or PBS. And it will be all about the stories of women struggling, you know, to get health care for their families in our current messed up system, where not only do people not have appropriate coverage, but just navigating the system is so frustrating and difficult for so many people. So I think stories are really, really a key part of advocacy, and I'm glad you asked that question.
When we go before decision-making bodies like city councils or the Metropolitan Water Board, we organize the presentations and put a lot of thought into that. Who should be there? We try to get a broad representation of the community. We try not to get a dentist to be the leader. We try to get somebody from the community that's well respected. It could be a young person, it could be a person of color, it could be an old person, it could be anybody. But somebody who can express in passionate terms the importance of the issue. And time again, passion will win the day. When people are bombarded with messages, a judge once told me that when somebody comes along and tells him something, he takes that as the truth, until somebody else comes along and tells him something else, and then he has to make up his mind. And I think that's the situation with a lot of issues that decision makers, whether they're at the city council level or the state level, Congress, the issues may be new to them. It may be HIV/AIDS, it may be women's issues, it may be fluoridation or dental health, and they don't have expertise in that. And so they depend upon individuals, lobbyists, whoever it may be, people from APHA who go and knock on their door and advocate. And you want to maintain that trust with those individuals as well and tell them the stories, because they'll come back to you for advice when the issue comes up again. So I just wanted to say that the stories are important, the passion is important, and the relationships are very important.
There was a question back here, I believe. Yes?
Me?
Yes.
I come from Hawaii, which has had a mandatory health insurance law, a mandatory employer-provided health insurance law since 1974, and I have never heard of anybody who is eligible for that coverage being denied by the insurance companies.
I was wondering, now that Massachusetts has passed similar laws, whether you are tracking whether that is changing in Massachusetts as well, that is, you know, how is that affecting access to health care and more universal health coverage?
Whether or not an insurer can deny coverage, say for a pre-existing condition, is dependent on state law. So what I gather is that in Hawaii, you have law that does not permit denials for pre-existing conditions.
There may be issues around treatment for a specific pre-existing condition, but to be denied health insurance coverage altogether for it, I have never heard of.
I assume
our
that
law mandates that anybody who works 19 hours, more than 19 hours a week for 4 weeks or more, must be provided with coverage, and the employer must pay at least half of the cost. And as a result, our health insurance costs are much lower than other states.
Oh. There's an excellent report on the website of Families USA, the National Consumer Health Organization, about pre-existing conditions and denials for pre-existing conditions, and it has state-by-state profiles. So if you're curious about your own state and whether, you know, people could be denied health insurance for a pre-existing condition, you can look up on that report and find out. As to your question about Massachusetts, the conference actually that we held last April was at Simmons College in Boston, specifically because we wanted to have it in a state that was experimenting with health reform. And we got a very mixed report, I have to say, back from the folks from Massachusetts who were there. On the one hand, quite a large number more people now have health insurance than didn't before the reforms, and most of the ones who did get it are lower income. On the other hand, they still have an affordability problem there. Some people just cannot afford to buy the health insurance that they've been mandated to buy, so the state is still exempting people from the requirement to have health insurance if it can be shown that they do not have the ability to actually afford a health insurance plan. And as well, the state, like most other states, is now in real serious financial shape. And of course, the cost of paying for this health reform is getting larger. So that's another problem. And the last thing I'd mention is that it turned out they have a lack of primary care physicians to meet the healthcare needs of all the people that now have health insurance. So there's quite a backlog of appointments developing there.
Thank you, Lois.
I'm a dentist from India, and I did my master's in public health. I'm currently just going to pass one more semester to go. I was wondering, I had a curious, I was just curious to know, you mentioned about fluoridation. I was also in charge or worked as fluoridation in rural areas with fluoridation camps, but due to this anti-fluoridation people, the camp got shut down and everything didn't work because my country doesn't consider oral care as a higher priority, first of all. I was wondering, like, you gave us such references of CDC and such big organizations supporting fluoridation. I was just curious, who are the organizations who support anti-fluoridation? I mean, you know what I mean? What is their basis of, I mean, what evidence they have, or which bigger organization, like if CDC is supporting you, APHSA, then what is their background? Please repeat the question.
The question was, the gentleman is a dentist from India, and he was asking about who are the forces that support non-fluoridation, right, in summary.
Right. It's a free country, and it's a free world. And First Amendment rights in the United States, which I support, ACLU member, guarantee freedom of expression and the right to say whatever you want to say. And I believe it's important to do that. I believe that we have to have better rhetoric than they. than they do. And so where did they get the support? They get the support from, as I said, in every community there are people who are opposed to it for various reasons. It may be a choice issue. It may be they don't trust government. They don't trust the experts. They are very skeptical individuals. They've had a member of the family or themselves suffer from a disease that modern medicine wasn't able to cure or treat properly. And so they feel disenfranchised in some way in that regard. They also feel exceptionally clever. And some of them are Harvard graduates, cum laude, and they think they know better than everybody else. And over the course of history, there have been individuals like that who have been proved right in the end. Semmelweis, for instance, who recommended washing your hands before doing surgery, was thought of as a crazy guy. Why should surgeons wash their hands? You know, they have the power of God. And so there have been individuals over time like that who've been proven right. And these individuals who feel the same way think that they will inevitably be found right. And they are supported by people who have lots of money to give away, or they get individual donations to their website and their cause.
Please. I mean, that was the fourth bullet on my second or third slide was assurance. And so the state agencies have to employ somebody to assure that these things are going on. And so that does happen from time to time. We monitor those things, certainly at the ADA, Jane monitors those things. And then when it's found out, then the local community that's in favor of reinstituting the fluoridation mobilizes and tries to convince the powers to be to continue it. Question? Yes.
I just have a question in regard to your campaigns, the difference between advocating and educating and lobbying. So when you go in front of your legislative leaders or your powers that be or your champions, talk a little bit about how you actually approach
them. Lois,
Well, first, the most important thing that we start with is building the relationship with them. And so that may not be about a specific ask. That may be about educating a particular member of Congress or member of a state legislature about some of the women's health issues that we're concerned about. Sometimes we might do something like invite them to be on a panel of presenting something to our organization or to some of the organizations that we work with. Then we are very careful to follow some of the suggestions that we've heard from the PEPFAR representative to make sure that we target the right members of Congress or legislature with the right ask. I mean, you have to make sure that you're tailoring your ask that way. And at that point, it does tip over from educating into advocating and maybe even lobbying. Probably the legal definition, you know, would be lobbying. So we have to try to keep it to a certain percentage since I'm a nonprofit. Right, and get foundation grants. When we go in and ask for a specific vote on a specific thing, that's lobbying. Otherwise, we're doing education and perhaps advocacy in a generalized term. Gosh, we wish, Senator Clinton, that you would do more about women's health issues. Let's talk about some of the things that you maybe might be interested in. Maybe you would sign on to this letter that Planned Parenthood is circulating. So we've there moved from general advocacy to a specific ask, will you sign that letter? Does that answer your question?
Yeah. So you actually do some lobbying.
Yeah.
You have to. Yeah.
Yeah. And we also do what's called under the IRS definitions, I think they call it grassroots lobbying, which means that we ask members of our field network to go talk to Senator Clinton to ask her to sign that letter. If we're doing that and asking them to do that, we're counted as doing lobbying also.
I think this is a very important question and something that's confusing to many of us at times, depending on what our job is, what our institution is, and then who we are as individuals. So oftentimes you have received emails from APHA asking you to take action, to write your legislators or your representatives or something. This is something you can always, always do as an individual. From your home machine, from your own email account, that's a right you have to do. If you work for the government, if you work for certain agencies that have certain status, 501c3, you may not be able to do this kind of work from your desk job. As an employee of such organization, you cannot go there, but as an individual, you can always go there. So when you receive these emails from us, you may not be able to do it from 9 to 5. You can do it at 8 o'clock from home, and we urge you to think about it. It's always about degrees of intensity, as Lois is pointing out. So thank you for that question. There was another question? Yes?
So I think a lot of times you learn more from your mistakes than from your successes. And you talked about sort of reviewing where you are in the campaign and redirecting based on what's working and not working. I'm just wondering if any of you have some mistakes that have built your campaigns that maybe the rest of us should have learned from.
Correct.
We feel that learning from mistakes, we feel that it's very important to set the groundwork before, you know, requesting the ask. If we go too soon to the decision-making body, the city council, whatever it may be, and we don't know whether they're in favor or against on an individual basis, targeting the individual person, we need to know where the five members of that city council stand before we ask them. And sometimes in a community, you know, somebody's, you know, a young dentist, it could be, believes that fluoridation's the world's greatest thing and moves to a new community and says, we don't have fluoridation. I'm going to go to the city council and I'm going to request that they fluoridate. And often that's met with immediate opposition because they've not been educated yet. They've not been told all the information. They haven't had the rebuttals to the claims, the false claims about and the myths about fluoridation. So we lost fluoridation at the city council level in Santa Cruz. In California, in Modesto, having won it before, it was reversed later. We lost initially in Escondido in San Diego County, but then we went back when there was a change in the composition of the city council, and we won the second time. So we don't always know why we fail. We think we've done the groundwork. We think it's okay. But there's somebody who's obstinate on that city council, and even though they're in a minority position, they can block it somehow. But we're persistent, and we don't take failure as the end. It's a long-term process sometimes.
We actually have a funny story of failure. When we were targeting a member of Congress in Connecticut, we realized that that member of Congress's office could not receive one of those automated emails that Jose you mentioned from, you know, like a large action alert. So
the 200 or so of our members who generated those automatic letters, actually none went to the member of Congress. They were actually in our own inbox. So what we did was, which is fine, remember, this is why it's important to know the framework that you're working in and who the target is. But it's fine because we then just put the letters together with one of our own fancy cover letters and, you know, faxed a letter to the member of Congress's office, or had our students deliver the letter to the member of Congress's office. So.
And we have time for a couple more questions.
I could offer one more example. If you
please,
want.
Yes.
Sometimes the kind of mistakes that we've made and that our colleagues have made have been in choosing the wrong strategy to get to where you want to go. When you're trying to make a change in policy, you can get there several ways. You can get there through legislation. You can get there through litigation, bringing a lawsuit. You can get there through using market-based mechanisms. You can get there through education. And so sometimes we pick the wrong strategy. And I would offer as an example another line of work that I've been working on, which is addressing this problem of the pharmacist that won't fill your birth control prescription. It's happened in a number of states around the country, and women's health advocates have been trying to figure out the best way to address it. Well, it turns out to depend on the state and the political environment there, which is some things that you talked about. So in a couple of cases in states, the advocates were all gung-ho to propose legislation. And we tried to help them with that because we figured they knew their state better. But it turned out that the political environment was not ready for legislation. And so it kind of backfired on them and us, and we got stuck. And so more recently, we've been using a strategy that didn't occur to us at first, but is turns out to be very effective. We hired a University of Washington pharmacy professor who is pro-choice and very much in favor of contraception and emergency contraception. And we've been sending him around to pharmacists association meetings to talk to the pharmacists about what is contraception, how does it work, and how is it not the same as abortion like you thought it was. And it turns out to have been extremely effective. We've changed the attitudes of many, many pharmacists who thought that the morning after pill was the same thing as the abortion pill, and increased access to emergency contraception in particular quite a bit through that strategy rather than trying to go the legislative strategy. So I guess I would encourage you to think about which is the best way to go depending on your situation. Keep in mind that if you want to do legislation, you got to have a lot of resources. You got to have volunteers, and you got to have money, and you got to have political connections, and you got to have a lot of time to work on it because it doesn't always go through right away. So really think through which of the options you want to pick to get to the goal you want to get to, because, you know, it might not be the most obvious one to you.
I just have a little story. I just came back from England and happened to have one of those TV screens in front of you on the back of the seat in front, and they were showing it was British Airways, and they had some BBC TV movies there, and one of them was called Filth. Filth in England is a euphemism for things that are smutty or you know, that kind of thing, rather than dirt. Anyway, so I was attracted to the title, and and also because Julie Walters, who's one of my favorite British actresses, was playing the lead of, she was portraying the role of Amy Winehouse. Amy Winehouse was an individual, a housewife, mother, who was very upset in the 60s when the BBC, the television, started changing its direction and programming, and she was very concerned about the smut on television and the degradation of the of the quality of television, and so she wrote letters and she mobilized a campaign. Got over 300,000 signatures. Got one of the members of the House of Commons to bring those signatures in front of the Prime Minister and the House, and was a very effective campaigner. And she didn't realize what she'd got, but she was convinced that this was the right thing to do, and there was enough groundswell, action on the street or something like that. I'm learning these terms now. You've got to have support on the street for your issue. If you're an individual going after something and you don't have a groundswell of support, you're unlikely to be successful. But she had that groundswell because everybody else was upset about that. So if you want to learn about mobilizing a campaign, I recommend you see Filth.
One last question.
I appreciated your use of the term the ask, a very specific sort of closing question to your target about are you with us or against us. And I remember a friend of mine is an office holder, a legislator, and he said he loves it when people come in and chat with him about their issue and let him nod and show sympathy and then go away and never pin him down about is he with them or against them. And so the ask, I think, is a very important little closing piece.
Yeah. Are you saying that he wants to have the ask asked?
No.
He doesn't.
He would much prefer not.
Because
show sympathy.
Right.
I think that for many of us, it's an uncomfortable position to be in. And we've all gone in the lobbying trip with our organization, and we sit around the room, and you bring the little brochure, and I wanted to tell you, and they have 2 minutes to hear your issue, and you don't close it with, we need your support. Where do you stand on this issue, or something like that? Then why bother? But it's not something that comes natural to all of us, the capacity to ask for what we want at a given point.
Making a pitch to a policymaker, try to think from their point of view and what will resonate with them. Like in this economic climate, we're expecting big budget cuts for health and human services in our legislature.
Right.
And when I go in and talk to them about it, I'm not going to talk about all the poor needy children who are going to suffer because their services are cut. I'm going to go in and tell them, the nonprofit sector is the fourth largest employer in our state. If you cut funding to nonprofits, you're going to increase unemployment. You are going to reduce the purchases that these nonprofits are making from local businesses. You're going to impact the real estate market, because that's going to resonate with people who care about the economy, who don't necessarily care about poor, needy people.
Right. So again, the issue needs to be framed according to who's your target? Who's your primary target? In record time, I want to thank our presenters. I want to thank you all for your participation, and have a good rest of the conference.